Furlong, reel number 7. Now, you've mentioned that you had these problems in familiarizing yourselves with some of the bombs with which you were issued, and in particular that on one particular bomb, the fuses to them you were unfamiliar with, and you had to carry out some experiments in order to get to know how to handle them. Where did you carry out these experiments, and what form did they take?
Well, we had a bit of a quarry on one end of the field, or a drop, you might say, of 6 feet, so that it shielded our train from them. Whatever happened down there wouldn't matter much. And we took we found the 112-pound bomb, for instance, had two fuses, which could be fitted. Of course, the fuses were in separate boxes. And there was one that went in the tail and one went in the nose. There was a certain amount of instruction on the actual fuse, which was very sketchy, but we gathered one was a sort of delay fuse, that's the one in the tail, and could be set to go off 2 or 3 seconds after it hit, the idea being it would go right through a building and go off. That was all right, and that was fairly easily understood. And then the front one had a screw-in fuse with a little wind vane on it, which puzzled us for a bit. And then we tumbled to the idea that it was so arranged that after it fell off the aeroplane, after it was released from the aeroplane, the wind vane would spin round, screw itself in, the point went in, and then when it hit the ground, off went the bomb. This, was, of course, was a safety device so that the bomb couldn't go off, or theoretically couldn't go off, if it was dropped from a very low altitude. Supposed to drop about 1,000 feet before it was armed, as they say. The other bombs, the 40-pound was no problem. The 20-pound Cooper was a little difficult, but we found out how it worked by fixing it up with a long string on it and then pulling and see what happened. It was all right when it went off, but when it didn't go off, it was a bit worrying as we didn't dare go near it again for a long time. Anyway, we found out how they worked, and very fortunately we didn't have any accidents.
Now, once you've got all these teething troubles out of the way, and you actually began your flying operations, what was your basic role? What was your fundamental task from Bakaritsa?
Well, the Bolsheviks were retreating south along the railway, as far as we were concerned, and our ground forces wanted to know where they'd got to and what lay ahead of them, because the maps were extremely sketchy, simply showed lines, and even those weren't accurate. So we went forward to, first of all, to try and contact them, and that was usually arranged by the fact that they started shooting at us. Then we knew they were where they were. Then we took photographs, which we brought back, and our own photographic unit developed them and sent them round to the army headquarters. That was all right. We carried bombs and machine gun bullets, armed machine guns, so that we could shoot at anything that we thought fit. And, of course, if necessary, to protect ourselves, which didn't, in fact, happen. But we used anything we'd got on anything we saw which looked a benefit to the enemy.
You've described to me your work along the railway line as being work along a 200-yard front. Mm. What do you mean by that exactly?
Well, you see, either side of the railway there was a slight clearing, perhaps 50 or 60 yards, and then you were into the forest. So the front line really consisted of a 200-yard line, 100 yards each side of the railway line, and this advanced forward with its edges, so to speak, in the forest either side, on the hopes, I suppose, that the enemy would not be able to expand sideways. We understand that the infantry did in fact create organised raiding parties that went round, but in the main this was the idea, a 100 yards line that kept moving forward after them as we chased them down.
Now, while you were advancing down the main railway line from Archangel. Were you in contact and coordinating your work with any other British military components that were in the area?
Yes, there were three fronts, really. The one we were on, which was the main line from Archangel south to Vologda and further south, there was on our left was the river front, the Onega front, which we understood was manned by part Navy and part infantry. And then there was a small force on our left going down another river and track, river and track. And our job was to go between the different points, dropping messages and taking photographs and then reporting back what we saw.
Now, when you made contact with Bolshevik forces down the length of the railway line, what form would the action take?
Well, the railway line was roughly divided into five verst lengths with a sort of station at roughly each five verst. These stations were primarily fueling stations. There was a small squad of men apparently stationed at each one who cut down wood, cut down the trees, chopped it up into suitable lengths and stacked it alongside the railway where the engines would pick up what they wanted. Now the Bolsheviks retreated from one to the other as they went back, and they set up their camps there, and we went along and made ourselves a nuisance by bombing them or see what was going on.
How did the Bolsheviks react to the kind of raids you would make on them? Did they have any form of defence?
Yes, they had an armoured train, which consisted of a truck with a gun or a couple of guns in it, which was pretty good. And this used to travel. We understood it had a coal engine, one of the few up there, and it had to go back to get its coal every so often. So it did travel. Otherwise, it was more or less up at the front station, where it would be protected by machine guns and other things most of the time. But our idea was to try and catch it in transit.
Did you ever succeed?
Yes, we caught it once, and I dived onto it and ran along the top with the chaps looking out each side. Fortunately, I was so close over the top they couldn't get their rifles out. But I dropped a couple of bombs, and although I appeared to be right slap over the train, neither of them appeared to hit anything. Anyway, the wretched train went on. So we emptied our front guns into the engine, and again it didn't stop the train. And then I swung out to one side, and my observer, who had side guns, he trained his guns onto the train, and we raked it the full length of the train as we flew back again. But we were very disappointed because nothing seemed to have happened. The old train was still punting along with the chaps looking out the windows. We heard some weeks afterwards, when some of these chaps were captured, that we had in fact done quite a bit of damage. We killed one or two that were in the train, and the bombs had in fact blown the side out of the carriage in which the chief gunner was, and either killed him or certainly laid him out.
Now, apart from the armoured train, did the Bolsheviks that were actually based on the various stations along the length of the railway line have the capability to defend themselves against your air operations?
Well, usually they had the armoured train, and of course that's where it usually sat, in the front station. Well, now, we developed the idea that we came over fairly high and saw what was at a distance, whether the train was in the station for a start off. Then we would go away and dive down on top of the forest and approach at right angles, very low, right on top of the trees, and come across the station at what is known as 0 feet. And it had the extraordinary effect, apparently, that the sound misled the people on the ground to think we were coming the other way. And every time we came over, they were looking the wrong way, something to do with the echo. The object was to rush across and drop what we'd got and disappear. Well, this went on happily for a while. And then we suddenly found the shells were not just going up in the air, they were dropping down on top of the forest, following us round. As we made our big sweep to come in, these shells were coming round behind us. And we realised they must have an observation post up a tree. So then we, as we got down low, we looked for the tallest tree and aimed straight at it and let fly our machine guns in the hopes that we would, we couldn't see it of course, and that we would catch the blokes up. Well, we did stop it once. What damage we did, we don't know. But that was the drill they got up to towards the end. It was a case of they tried something and then we tried to counteract it.
Apart from these operations involving bombing and the reconnaissance work, did the air component of which you were a part do any other kinds of work?
Yes, we did artillery observation. At one time, they found a naval gun, a big naval gun, and they mounted it on a truck and they brought it forward. And we were sent up to try and spot for it in the usual way. My observer was a well-experienced man in this sort of thing, and he knew the drill. But it wasn't very successful because we couldn't see the bursts in the forest. And they shot our aerial off on one occasion, and they made themselves an awful nuisance because we were sitting ducks up there to and froing, and with nothing else to shoot at, they concentrate everything they got on us. It got very uncomfortable at times. But this went on, and I don't think we ever really registered a hit. We registered one or two over, one or two short. We just couldn't see them burst for some reason or other. We saw the guns fire. We actually saw the shells coming up sometimes.
And you could see the targets quite clearly.
Oh, we could see the targets, yes.
But you never saw the shells.
We never seemed to see the shell burst.
Now, what was coordination and communication like between the RFC personnel and the ground units which you were supposed to be working in conjunction with?
Well, we had radio, but it wasn't very successful. And we had message bags which we could drop messages with streamers on. And, of course, we had a code whereby the ground forces put out letters meaning certain things. But all this was very limited. But in the main, we had to wait until we got back to base where we made our report, which was telephoned or sent by messenger to headquarters. And, of course, we received back comments and further instructions for the next operation. So what they wanted done, what they wanted photographed, etc.
What sort of problems did this communication create? Presumably there was one of delay.
It was delay, and they had some funny things they gave us to do. One day our colonel apparently said that he would get some photographs of a certain object on the breakfast table for the general. Well, this was 8 o'clock at night, they told us this. Anyway, we set off before dawn with no night landing gear at all. We shot off into the dark, organising to get to our target at daybreak, which we did. This was nearly 100 miles away. And we took our photographs and we got back. And we handed them in and we had them developed. Unfortunately, the light was so bad that although you could see there were photographs, you couldn't really see much on them. Mm. So we carried out our mission, but it was really wasted time. I suppose that happens all along.
Now, despite the fact that you, because you were occupied exclusively with air operations, presumably your direct contact with ground forces was very limited indeed. In fact, did you have any?
No. I should say not, except when we had landed. apart from the odd bits of signalling we were able to do, there was no contact between us.
What kind of treatment was? You've mentioned that the Bolsheviks tended to treat Allied soldiers who fell into their hands pretty brutally. Could you tell me about that and what kind of effect it had on you?
On more than one occasion, they came upon some of our people who'd been captured, who'd been mutilated, badly mutilated. This led us to the decision that we were not going to be captured under any circumstances. So that we arranged to carry revolvers, and we had iron rations, of course. In case we landed, we hoped to be able to get back through the forest. But we carried the revolvers not only to defend ourselves, but to finish ourselves off if necessary.
Rather than fall into Bolshevik hands.
Exactly.